again, back on live radio. Hey everyone, you're listening to Affirmative Reaction. Oh, I like this song. You're listening to Affirmative Reaction. Sorry, ADD. You're listening to Affirmative Reaction here on SiriusXM Progress Channel 127. I'm your host, Jorge Olivares. Apologies for the issues that we're dealing with on a technical level. We're still trying to get those figured out. But I just want to, yet again, reintroduce you to my guest, Kelly Dunham, genderqueer ex-nun comedian, who is recording their latest album, Not the Gym Teacher, later today at Caveat at 4 p.m. If you're in the New York City area, please try to make it down. You can also follow Kelly on Twitter at Kelly Dunham, and Marianne Palacios, also educator, somebody who is Cuban American, Latina, queer, and a part of the LGBTQ Catholic ministry that I'm a part of here in New York City. And when I knew that Kelly was coming on the show, I immediately texted Marianne. I said, I would love to incorporate you in the conversation because I find it so fascinating. And I was talking to Senator Gustavo Rivera about this too, this intersectionality of how those of us who have been incredibly comfortable or who have come to terms with our sexuality still find a way to bridge our spirituality in it. Now, Kelly, what I find incredibly fascinating about your story is you said that you were a convert, that you were not Catholic and then eventually became Catholic, which is then how you transitioned to becoming a nun, correct?
Yes, that's accurate.
So what was the genesis of that idea of like maybe Catholicism was something that you wanted to pursue or align yourself with even for a little bit?
So I grew up evangelical Christian, right? Like born again, you know, went to a small Christian high school that made a rule actually halfway through that girls couldn't wear flannel shirts with t-shirts under them, you know, like, which was clearly about me. Like,
yeah.
like a special homophobic
like,
school.
Kelly.
mm-hmm. And actually, I often say like that was not as bad. That is not a bad way to grow up in the 80s as a queer, right? Like I had a lot of attention. I had a lot of structure. I mean, learned to hate myself, true, but.
As we all do at
right,
some point.
Right. But that was like kind of, you know, there was a lot of structure and a lot of adults who asked about my day and listened to the answer, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was living in Haiti, long story on that. I flunked out of Bible college and they were like, somebody was like, oh, I have a friend who is working at this school for kids with disabilities and they need somebody to help and you don't need any special skills. And I was like, oh my God, that's me. I don't have any special skills.
That's my calling. So,
exactly. So I met the Missionaries of Charity when I was there. It was like during the time right after the Duvaliers left, when it was like kind of one coup after another and the kids had been sent home to live in the provinces. And so I ended up volunteering with the Missionaries of Charity and that I met them. And to become a nun is actually why I converted to Catholicism.
What was it about the religious life that you thought was calling your name? And do you think, and I think a lot of people say this, especially when it comes to this particular vocation, they feel like either it's a spiritual calling, a divine calling, like that there was a moment where they realized this is what's next for me. Did you have that moment?
Yes. A series of moments, I suppose. But one of the things, so I was living in Haiti, and Haiti, you know, is like a place that colonialism has just shit on so mightily, you know, and so it's full of still people shitting on Haiti, you know, like helping, but shitting on. And the Missionaries of Charity have this like kind of different, I don't know that it's completely different, but it's folks from all around the world, right? So there's like Haitian nuns and American nuns and tons of Indian nuns and like folks working all together and kind of living a little bit more simple life also. And also just doing kind of the next thing. Like, oh, you're hungry? Here's some food. Let's figure this out together. So, you know, there was that, like a kind of very different kind of living and more of a mutual aid than a like helping with a capital H. Also, their forearms were really muscled from doing manual labor, so, you know, there was that, too. And it just felt like, oh, yeah, this is my place. This is the place for me.
Nice. Now, Marianne and I have talked a lot about how, with regards to, obviously, the Catholic Church has been incredibly misogynistic and very sexist, and especially with limiting the role that women can have. If I'm not mistaken, you've talked about before with me about the idea of pursuing becoming a nun or entering the religious life in some way. Mm-hmm. In the same way that Kelly was sort of describing it for them, what like was there that moment where you thought, man, maybe I should listen to this voice?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was first beginning to teach, I was in my early 20s and I was at an all-girls Catholic school that's run by an order of nuns. And I was surprised with how much I loved teaching and how much I loved serving God in that way. And I was obviously not dating anyone, figuring out my own sexuality. And I had some ideas of what was going on. But ultimately, I recognized, hey, if I join an order of nuns, this order of nuns that I'm working with, that I care so much about, that has this beautiful mission, then I can do the work I really care about and also serve God and live with a bunch of women. Which at the time seemed like
a double win.
The perfect plan for my life.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, it was the director of vocations for that order, who I met with a couple times, who convinced me not to do it. Because she said to me, she's much older, she's sadly passed away since then, but she said to me, "You are far too independent to enter into a society where you will have to listen to men telling you what to do for the rest of your life." I was like, no, you're run by ladies. And she was like, yeah, and we have to listen to the bishop. And you will never be a bishop. None of us will. And that's not what started my long descent into trying to tear down the patriarchy, but it was definitely a big part of that journey of mine.
You should let our listeners know, what does your shirt say?
Oh, it says, "Screw the patriarchy."
Very apt for the conversation that we're currently having.
Yeah, it's my church shirt.
Kelly, just hearing what Marianne was saying about this idea of always having to take orders from men, or how inevitably when it comes to the Catholic Church, men are the deciding voice. Was that something that in your experience is what you encountered?
Well, one thing, when you talked about like the just being surrounded by women, there was a moment in when I was like, you know, I'd been there like maybe a year and it wasn't working out so great, but we were all standing around a statue of Mary in like the twilight and singing. And I looked around, I was like, I get to be with these beautiful women for the rest of my life. And then I was like, I wonder if this is what everyone else is. I'm pretty sure this is not what we're supposed to be thinking about anyway. But so, you know, the Missionaries of Charity, they're Mother Teresa's gang of nuns, right? Mm-hmm. So Mother Teresa's a very strong figurehead. Like, nobody's gonna fuck with Mother Teresa because she's very extremely, even now, even though there's controversies, she's extremely good PR for the Catholic Church, like maybe one of the best PR things in the last 50 years, right? So there is in which I would say the Missionaries of Charity are very, like, you know, talk about the Holy Father like they want to give him a hand job, like they are extremely oriented towards the patriarchy, but yes, but also the hierarchy. But they also kind of operate outside, not outside of it, but they have a lot of social capital in that way because, you know, people love Mother Teresa. So,
and I mean, you agreed to the labeling of the convent as just that life is somewhat cultish, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially the focus on obedience. And that was the part that I always had, though, really. Like, what?
Why do I have to listen to this?
No, I don't think that sounds like a good idea. Yeah.
Well, like for listeners, when you kind of use a word like that, what are some of the examples that you can provide that show just how cultish something like this can be?
Well, we're supposed to, anything that your superior said, you right? This is across, but not everybody across convents or religious orders, but not everybody has the same very literal interpretation, but that the voice of your superior is the voice of God in all things but sin. So like, for example, at one point they're like, okay, sisters, because we love Jesus, we're going to mortify ourselves by only going to the bathroom once a day. And I was like, I just thought that was kidding. Like, she was kidding. I was like, oh yeah, call me Sister Mary bladder infection. But that was not. And, you know, just like the, like during Holy Week, you know, like we're like cleaning the ceiling and, you know, like crawling upstairs on our knees and, you know, just like this, really like this focus just on the suffering of Jesus and also our own suffering. I remember my mistress asked me like, oh, what does it remind you of when you see things neat and orderly? And I was like, obsessive compulsive disorder. But the right answer was God, as it turned out.
It's always God. It always comes back to God.
Yeah.
Marian, do you see kind of that way of being, like that, either based off the nuns that you encountered or even based off of religious life at school, that there's like a cultish way about it, that somehow we've been conditioned to think is okay and cool, and that maybe we ourselves want to be associated with it?
Yeah, there's all kinds of things, right? When I was a kid and I was cantering at masses, this is the first time that I really noticed just this whole group of people standing up and reciting something together. Mm. And when you're doing a mass at a school, the students typically have like a very bored look on their faces and they're just sort of saying these words and they're not even thinking about it. And so I remember standing up there like singing and just seeing everyone stand up, sit down, recite stuff, sing stuff. And I was like, this is creepy. Like, it's a little cultish. And then when you really start looking at a lot of our traditions, we don't ask why some of the time, and we just do it. And I think that can can be a little creepy sometimes.
The thing about Catholicism, and I'm sure this could be the case for a lot of different religions, and if it is, call us 866-997-4748. When you think about this weird spiritual religious journey that we've each been on as people in this world. But like the idea of whenever we do the profession of faith or whenever like we do anything, like it's just literally all the same people, all monotonously just say, we believe in one God, the Father Almighty, whatever, whatever. Like, and you just do it because your mind already knows that at a particular point you say this, you do that, you kneel here, you stand up here, you genuflect here, you amen here. Like the repetition of it just makes you think like, wow, why don't we do anything differently? Like, mm-hmm. why don't we just, you know, kneel at this part? Why do we have to only kneel at this part? I don't know. I just find that world and entire thing fascinating. Especially, I find it fascinating for people who did not grow up that way and then found their way into specifically the Catholic Church. Were there a lot of similarities between growing up evangelical and then converting to Catholicism as an adult that you saw that you thought, maybe both of these are weird?
Well, there is a whole thing, right? Like if you have like kind of liberal Catholicism and liberal evangelicalism don't look that close, but conservative of both, right? Like even if you talk to like somebody who's a conservative Mormon, you're like, wow, that sounds just like being a nun. You know, like there is something in which all the religions overtwine because it's about control and, you know, it's more of a psychology than a theology.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I find the... So I want to tell you a secret. Yes. I still sneak into the back of churches sometimes. I love the mass. I love the repetition. It's very soothing to me. That's actually something, because you grew up evangelical, somebody could say some shit at any time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up like, and at some point my mom was going at this church where people would dance in the spirit. You know, and like if people are dancing in the spirit, you're like, what the fuck's going to happen next? Like there's no chance
yeah.
to like actually just be like, oh, okay. Like it's very stimulating and not altogether pleasant way. So I would say that there is something for me I definitely agree about like the chanting and like the, and also that it's kind of so focused. I remember we were supposed to do that, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, which goes like, for the sake of his sorrowful passion. Like you do it like 30 times, have mercy. And it's so depressing. Like what could be more depressing than, you know, Jorge, for the sake of his art. Like, if I said that to you, you would be like, don't come on this show anymore, you know?
So you stopped going to church after you left the convent?
So, I left the convent because they were like, I mean, basically because I was like, oh, this is not making me a good person. And this is making me a worse person. So, I kind of like got on the bus at Port Authority, just went to my sister's house. And I thought maybe I would go back after like I got myself together somehow, which, you know, instead I just came out as a queer person. But for a long time, I actually was more involved in like the Catholic Worker and that kind of thing, like that kind of radical Catholics. I'm not as much anymore, but I still have like a big heart for that. And mm-hmm. now I feel like I've kind of, I don't know, I feel like almost like Queer Memoir, the storytelling show that I run,
yes.
is like kind of like my church, you know, like people come and they tell their stories and that's, you know, yeah.
It is. So Queer Memoir is New York City's longest running, most super earnest LGBT storytelling event. And Kelly has also authored several books. And I'm curious, because Marianne and I have had many conversations about what it would take for us to leave the church or just stop going to mass. And there are times where you've said just like, yeah, I'm not going today because I don't have it in me. Because it's sometimes as a queer person, specifically as a queer woman, you've told me, and I don't want to speak for you because I have you here to be able to speak for you to say it, but about just the difficulty of that dual identity mm-hmm. and how going to church when that dual identity isn't respected, how it takes a lot from you to be able to just sit there and take it.
Yeah, no, it's something I struggle with probably every Sunday. It's a decision I have to make, and I try to listen to the Spirit as much as I can. Because some days I do have it in me to go, and sometimes it's very life-giving to be at Mass, to see my community, to see my friends. Sometimes the homilies are wonderful, and, you know, taking Eucharist feels really, really good. Other times I'm sitting there, maybe it's a priest that I've had an argument with, maybe mm-hmm. the reading's something that is not speaking to me. I always have a hard time at Pentecost because the tradition at our parish is to have all of the fathers go up on the altar and you have like this wall of men. And for me, that image is really difficult to just see and recognize that I'm part of this. I'm complicit in this church that is so patriarchal and says and teaches so many things that I don't agree with. So it's something I do struggle with all the time. And I try to listen as much as I can to the spirit and see, like, is this life-giving for me today? Is it not? And I always forgive myself for either thing, right? Mm-hmm. So if I feel like going and being part of it that day, that's great. And if I don't another day, that's fine too. Maybe I'll call a good friend and have a conversation. Sometimes I go and stand outside and walk around the block. Sometimes I've gone and then left and then met up with people after. I just have to take care of myself first, because church and going to mass can be incredibly life-giving. It can be a wonderful kind of self-care, but so can leaving. And I think it's important that we tell people that, and that we also make the space for people to be there, but also for people to not be there, because we're all in this community together, right? And we have to take care of one another.
Mm-hmm. I think something that I've come to recognize, and I don't want to say embrace, but this idea of spiritual violence and how mm-hmm. things within the spiritual world, within the religious world, that can be, I mean, not against our person per se, but like there is a violence that is enacted upon us whenever we walk into a space that doesn't necessarily want us there. Mm-hmm. And there's many instances in which the Catholic hierarchy has come out and said things, even the Pope saying very transphobic things and very anti-queer things, that when you want to put yourself in your vulnerable state in these pews, you're like, why? Why am I doing this other than for the tradition of having done it for all of my life? Now, for our listeners, because I've heard you say this, Marianne, for our listeners, what are some of the requirements that you have met in order to become a priest yourself, if gender were not a part of the conversation?
Well, to be really clear, I don't think I have a vocation to the priesthood.
Yes.
I am just very bothered that I am not allowed to. As an employer, I can't believe the Catholic Church gets away with this. But for me to become a priest, or for anybody, you'd have to get basically a master's in divinity. So you would need like a theology undergrad degree and then a master's in divinity. Like, I have a master's degree. I have plenty of female friends who have MDivs. I work with them. We work at a Catholic school. And there's not a whole lot that women, you know, who I know don't have other than what I call a ministry stick in becoming a priest. And it really frustrates me. As a woman, as an educator of women, I find it to be just horrific. Probably mm-hmm. my least favorite thing about the Catholic Church is the fact that women are only able to take 6 of the 7 sacraments. What's that about?
Yeah.
Jesus mm-hmm. never said we couldn't, right?
So true.
And I mean, I could go on about this for days. No,
but I love it. I love it because I think many people, with regards to the Catholic Church, with regards to any sort of institutionalized religion, that we forget that these are things that take place behind the scenes, because we're so just conditioned to go about our day to day. Like, this is what it's always been. This is what we've come to accept. When it really is affecting people's lives. And like the benefit that a lot of parishes would have if they welcomed female priests, or if they welcomed queer
female
people.
Voices.
Yes.
At our own parish, women are never giving homilies or giving reflections after the gospel. How ridiculous is that, right? Mm-hmm. You're not letting half of the church be heard or be seen. And that to me is so wrong.
Yeah. I remember when I went home, this was maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and we had a new hometown priest. That's the Oblates of Mary Immaculate, so they are always transferring every so often. And so I did not know who this priest was. And I remember that it was only after I left my hometown parish that they started doing the wine as well as the body of Christ. And they only let women do the wine. They never let them give the actual Eucharist. And I always found that so, like, obviously bonkers. And I remember I brought it up to my mom during, like, we were about to get up and to go in line for communion. I was like, well, that's some shit. And my mom gets so mad. But it's like, how is it that even something as small as allowing women to be full Eucharistic ministers, giving the body of Christ. I'm very glad that at least in our parish, they do that. Yeah. There are women who do that, especially next to the priest. But I'm curious for you, Kelly, like, are any of these things stuff that you've ever thought about? Like, not necessarily maybe pursuing the priesthood, but like the limitations that women, that queer people have had within the church. And was that part of the reason why you felt like it wasn't for you anymore?
Well, I was not out when I came, when I started or when I ended the nunhood. I was just so out of touch with everything, like with my own attractions, with my own body, everything. So it wasn't so much that specifically. It was just clear that I, you know, like the nun said, I had insufficient docility and too much self-esteem. That was like, so clearly, like, that's a bad fit.
How dare you feel nicely about yourself?
Yeah, that's, you know, it's a termination notice you're only going to get from the convent, right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of was the specifically the misfit, because there were so many other things about that life I loved, you know. I tell the story of... the day after Easter is called M's Missionary of Charity Easter. And like, we got together and played this basketball game where, like, you know, let Lou on the basketball court, like they become like women who run with the wolves, you know, like, there was one sister who like blocked a shot and scratched my hand. And she's like, oh my God, you have the stigmata. And she's like running down the court, you know? These really, really beautiful moments, including work moments, working together and praying around statues and all that. And that was a very real, beautiful part. And I can't say I don't miss it. I mean, my queer life has in some ways replaced that, but I can't say that I miss it. But what I think in terms of, even, okay, so women can't be in leadership. What does that say? I just think of, I have a friend who, an African-American friend who was saying to her son after Obama was elected, well, now I can tell you that you really can be anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like something like that, where it's so clearly by just girls being around something where, well, you're not allowed to be in leadership, what that says to them. How can you live like a faithful Catholic life and then that comes down on you? There's no way that doesn't impact you. You mm-hmm. know, there's no way that doesn't impact you. And that is an act of violence, right? To like, yeah. you know, to tell folks that they're, you know, well, first of all, you know, like the biological essentialism is ridiculous anyway, but beyond that, like, how can half the world like not, and how can we say that? How can we say that to young girls?
You yeah.
know? Well, we're telling them that they can't be close to God in the way that men can. And that is a form of spiritual violence. And I've taught in all girls Catholic schools my entire career. And I went to them as a student. And just thinking there are all these young women who are getting this message at home and at school. And it's awful. We're saying you cannot be a leader. You cannot be close to God. Men will always be better than you. And how dare we be part of this church that does that? And that's my constant struggle.
I love that there is, even within these weird instances of marginalization within the church, that we have been able to find some sort of community. Marianne and myself, because of our LGBTQ ministry and the friends that we've made through there. And Kelly, I'm sure even being a part of the convent and the community that you create from that, and even from queer people who might have left the church and the community that brings. Who are some of these community members that you've met, and how has that been able to carry you forward after ending that chapter of your life?
I mean, it's interesting. It's probably been a half dozen years now. I went on this Southern tour, and like it was going to be a Southern tour through small towns. In most small towns in the South, there is not a gay bar, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a metropolitan community church, the gay church, right? Mm-hmm. So I ended up doing a metropolitan community church tour, essentially, which actually churches are great for comedy because they already have a mic. They already have people who come, you know what I mean? It's actually kind of a setup in that way. And watching folks and, you know, like somebody in a small town in, you know, rural Tennessee, this is like this is their hope, you know? Mm-hmm. And so seeing that's kind of a radical community, right? That's like a radical commitment to community to say like, I have to stay in this area because it's my home, maybe, or because my kids are here, or for many reasons, right? But I will find community. And, you know, I feel like that is even when we talk about social media and stuff where people are like, oh, it's so bad, but it's like social media and texting all the time, all that is about trying to connect. It's so deep in us, you know, it's just so deep that like it's almost like our default, you know, even mm-hmm. when we kind of mess it up. So I see so many, like, you know, kind of radical community ideas, you know?
I love the way you phrase that this is their hope. Like, the people genuinely need this in order to just fulfill that part within them that they feel has been empty for quite some time. And I can only imagine the community that you make also as educators, right? Like, you've been able to be a part of this community, Marianne, of going to an all-girls school and an all-girls Catholic school, the community of educators that you can make there, just with the students that you have there. But I'm if you can, talk about the making, the formation of these communities, but also the difficulties that those communities have brought to you.
Ooh, that's a tough one, Jorge.
I know.
I'm very blessed currently because I'm working at a really wonderful all-girls Catholic school here in Manhattan, and I have not found anything but support and love from the people I work with. Everyone knows what my life is about. They know my life story, and everyone is incredibly supportive. And you build community in school just, you know, through many different things. One of our goals at our school is to have community because it's a Christian value, and we really do deliberate things to build that community and make sure we're a kind community. And my students are great. My students are wonderful, and they're very loving. But, you know, everyone is different. Everyone gets into problems, and we have all kinds of stuff that goes on. And I really can't get into stuff too much.
No, I know.
But yeah, we run into some problems where people don't agree with each other, and we have to really think very carefully about how to handle the situations, especially with kids, right? Because sometimes a kid will say something because she's a child, but what she's saying could be very dangerous. It could be very hurtful. So it's something that, as in my role of Dean of Students, I deal with every day, right? I'm having these conversations with kids all the time, and I'm so blessed and lucky that I get to do that work.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it's hard. Sometimes I have to talk a kid off of like a homophobic rant. Mm. And she maybe doesn't even know that's what she's doing.
Yeah. I love that another component that is shared among my guests is the fact that you all are educators and you work in the school system. Kelly, for our listeners, what does that entail? Like being a part of the school system, and do you work as a nurse at the school, or how does?
I don't actually work as a nurse. I work in the school system as I'm a community school director. So basically, anything that doesn't have anything to do with academics, that's what I do. Like I help out with the, you know, we have a mental health clinic, we have a primary care clinic, like all that kind of like negotiating that stuff. We're basically to support kids so they can be students and adults so they can be teachers and, you know, to try and pull away some of those obstacles from having education. I feel really lucky. This job is, it's, they're my family. Absolutely. The folks that I work with are my family. And, you know, I said the first principal that I worked at with there, she said, I love you more than my mom does. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of an amazing place. And I'd been there like 3 weeks and she said, you know, Kelly, if there's any reason that it would be helpful for you to be out to the kids, please feel free. And when I was, you know, when I first started my nursing job, I had a boss who kept telling me, who kept giving this feedback about how I was dressing, but it was kind of vague. And then so finally, I finally brought in a Lane Bryant catalog, and I was just, please circle what you want me to wear. And it was that I was dressing too masculine, right? Mm-hmm. Like literally, but she didn't even have the words for it. She just felt like I was just objectionable on the face of it. And I feel so lucky that the world, even though the world is like a total shithole in some ways right now and kind of always, I feel so lucky that the world has changed in this way that I get to bring my whole self. Of course, it's always about the kids, right? So that might not be helpful information for kids, but I keep a picture of my girlfriend on my desk. And kids come out to me because of that. They're like, is that your girlfriend? Yep. I got a girlfriend. I mean, at least a half dozen times, you know? And I think about what it would have been like for me to see somebody who looked like me happy as an adult. That would have been so amazing. So I feel like just being present, you know, I feel super, 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 super lucky to have that particular, to have this experience.
I love that you make that distinction about seeing an adult happy, a queer adult happy in their place of employment or wherever they are, because I think that makes all the difference, right? When you were a young kid and you're like, oh, this person's gay, this person looks like they're enjoying life, I could probably have that too. And I know, Marianne, you've kind of been in the same position where some students have felt comfortable enough to come to you about their own identity journey. Mm-hmm. And I can see, because my sister's still a teacher, my parents are retired teachers, but my sister has had, because she talks openly about her gay brother and how she is an ally and she's marched in pride at the local hometown pride that we have. So her students also feel like there is a comfortable adult that they can go to where they can give this very vulnerable information about themselves that they feel like they can't really tell anybody else. Mm-hmm. Has that happened? I know about one student in particular, but has it happened more often about students who feel like that you can be that person for them that can kind of give them the hope?
I mean, it comes in waves with me with kids. Many years ago when I was teaching in Florida, I had a whole group of girls come out to me. With middle schoolers, it's different. I don't really bring it up with middle school children because it doesn't feel totally appropriate or relevant. I've never lied about it. I would never shy away from it. But my personal life is my personal life. The kids can all tell you lots of stuff about my dog because that's what they care about and that's what they ask me about. But, you know, I have pictures of my friends up. I have HRC stickers. I have, you know, Safe Space stuff. I have St. Paul's stuff up. So the observant kids for sure know. And some students do come to my office and they'll casually slip it in. And that's it's really rewarding and validating for me. But it's also great for me to sort of just be like, yeah, great, cool. This is not a big deal. This is not anything that we need to really sit here and cry about. But they know I'm there for them. And they know that they can come and share what's going on. And I'm always going to be supportive of whatever they're going through.
Yeah.
And I have had students, especially many years ago when I was down in Miami, I did have students come to me and express that they were very, very nervous because they didn't know how their families would react. And in that situation, I was lucky that I got to sort of help mother these girls and really be there for them when their own parents maybe were not available.
Mm-hmm. Kelly, was when the process came for telling your family about your identity, was it a difficult path? Was it something that what was more difficult to tell family members? Was it about entering the convent, exiting the convent, entering your queer life in the way that it should have been from the beginning, if that's how you felt?
Well, when I entered the convent, I had been living in Haiti when they're having like one coup after another. And so my like mom was always kind of worried about me. So that kind of helped a little bit. Like, she was like, all right, well, at least you'll be in some place with concrete walls and you'll have health insurance or, you know, healthcare, not health insurance, but healthcare. You know, because ultimately, even like think homophobic parents, like that's kind of what they want. Right. Like, not always. But my mom has never been my mom has just never been a parent who thinks her kids are like a reflection of her. Like, she's just like, oh, you're a person and that's, you know, fine. But, well, first of all, I had her meet my girlfriend at the time, didn't tell her it was my girlfriend. And then I sent her a letter that said that this was my girlfriend. But I forgot to say, like, can you write me back or something? Which, you know, that was like a little bit of a mistake. But then she had like a little bit of reaction. She ripped up my birth certificate and sent it to me. Like, that was kind of her first reaction. Which I was like, eh, that seems like I was complaining to my therapist. And I was like, that's so passive aggressive. And she was like, no, no, that's aggressive.
Yeah, that's quite aggressive.
If you would ask my mom now, I'm sure she would say that that is not what happened. But actually, this amazing thing happened. You know, we went through some like stuff and I think she watched a lot of Ellen on TV. And, you know, and also she's an evangelical Christian. So it's like a struggle in that way. But my partner died and her husband died in the same year. And I was able to come and like set up hospice for her and, you know, arrange funeral and just like sit with her for the week after her husband died and just be quiet, which is often what you need like in those situations. And I felt like that was such a weird thing to say like, oh, I feel so lucky that we had that experience. But it was the thing that turned our relationship around. Like, mm-hmm. she saw me as a person. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, I feel grateful that our relationship is what it is now.
How long ago was that moment with the birth certificate?
Late 90s, so yeah, ages.
Yeah, that's so crazy. Like, I've always reminded myself that I'm incredibly blessed with how my family responded to my coming out. There was a brief moment where I didn't know where my dad was going to feel about it, but then that ended up not materializing the way that I thought it was. Because I think all of us as queer people, and it's a common refrain that we all have, where you kind of prepare yourself for the worst because you, I don't know, society just makes you think that the worst is about to happen. And it's difficult that I think people have to experience that in order to realize the growth that they can just have for themselves. And I know, do you still volunteer, Marianne, with the Trevor Project?
Every now and then, yeah. Every now and then I still pop on the line, but it's not as often as I used to.
But I remember when you were doing it kind of in full force, mm-hmm. when you told me the sheer amount of people that you were communicating with.
Yeah.
Like, it just, it reminds you that there are instances where something like Kelly's mom's reaction is happening all over and people don't really know how to respond to it.
And all the time, you know, when I was active on Trevor, we would have lines of 15, 16 people waiting to talk to somebody, and their kids waiting to talk to someone. And we would have 4 or 5 counselors. This is just my plug for everyone to go volunteer for Trevor, by the
way.
Yeah,
I should. So the Trevor Project, for those who don't know, the Trevor Project is this life-saving lifeline, essentially, where people, LGBTQ vulnerable youth, can call if they're having certain ideations that somebody can help with if they have a chance
when
to.
It's for youth in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone under the age of 26 and over the age of 12, though sometimes I got 10 and 11-year-olds who are in crisis for whatever reason. Sometimes they saw something transphobic or homophobic on TV. Sometimes they've been kicked out of their homes by their parents. And so we provide basically suicide. It's basically a suicide hotline, but we do provide services. We provide someone to talk to, and we get people help, which is really great. I'm very lucky to be part of that organization. And if you have some time, I really suggest volunteering with the Trevor Project.
So for those of you, I highly recommend, again, if you just go to their Twitter page, if you just go to any LGBTQ organization at large, because we're currently part of an administration that doesn't want us to have rights. But the Trevor Project, because when we think about these youth, when we think about kids who are still trying to figure out where they stand in this whole society, this whole place, if we can be of help to them, I think that'd be really beneficial. But we have to take one little break. When we come back, we'll have a few more minutes with my guests. Again, we'll give you a chance to figure out where you can see Kelly live, especially for the recording of their album. And yeah, we'll be back after this.